Hello and welcome to this edition of the BowlersDesk.com political podcast with me, Matt Bowler, and Rick Epps. This time we sat down with David Alvarez. He's councilman from District 8. I'm looking at his page right now, and that's the district that goes through Barrio Logan, Sherman Heights, Stockton, Tijuana River Valley, Ocean View Hills, Otay Mesa, kind of that area that runs from a little bit south where Barrio Logan is and kind of skirts down along the coast where the kind of the city of San Diego runs with National City and Chula Vista there on its side all the way down to Otay Mesa, which is immediately along the border. David's one of these he's a soft-spoken guy. He's he's kind of the prodigal son in a way. When he went to San Diego State, he didn't leave home, but he did get a fellowship and go to Sacramento and then come back and run for city council and won in a special election. Nobody really thought he was going to win, but he did. And now he's running for mayor. And a lot of people are questioning whether or not he can have an opportunity, whether he will really make his mark here, win mayor's race. He's up against some heavyweights locally with Kevin Faulkner and Nathan Fletcher. This guy's a very interesting guy. He's soft-spoken, does not come from a privileged background. But, you know, this is America, and a lot of people don't come from privileged backgrounds. Kevin Faulkner, Nathan Fletcher's working class. But David Alvarez's, parents came up here as part of the Bracero program and basically worked the fields until they settled in San Diego, where he was born. He did not grow up in the 80s and 90s and Barrio Logan was definitely not a safe neighborhood to grow up in, but, he did, and he did really well for himself. So, majored in psychology at San Diego State. He's an interesting guy to talk to, kind of outlined his plan for the city, outlined his idea of what government should do, what it shouldn't do, and, what he hopes to do, and how he's going to be different, especially when compared to his opponents. Very interesting, I hope you give it a listen, and if you hear anything on there that you like or dislike, feel free to give us a call, 619-663-4531. You can hop on our soapbox or hop on your soapbox by hopping on ours. How's that go again? Hop on your soapbox by hopping on ours. Call the political podcast message line. Leave us a message. Tell us what you think, 619-663-4531. So without any further ado, we met up with David in his campaign headquarters, which also happens to be his garage. So there's a bit of an echo on the recording, but I don't think that matters much. I hope you enjoy. It was an interesting conversation. Probably the first time a lot of people, I think, outside of his district are really going to get to spend some time with him and get to know him, so let us know what you think. Enjoy.
When you came in?
Are we recording?
Yeah.
Oh.
Uh-oh. You're a genuine, real human being.
Hook up there.
All right. You're a genuine, don't put on the David Alvarez candidate face right here.
No,
all right? We had the David Alvarez person.
Okay.
Who's eating the pandulce I brought over.
That was because
he's letting us in his campaign office, which is his garage, his house.
Yeah, bring some for all of us, man.
There's enough there for you if you want some pandulce. So there's a couple empanadas there. I've got plenty at home, though, that's for sure.
So yeah, my dad was bracero, but he did the cotton picking and the, he spent time in Arizona and Imperial County, not San Diego, I don't think ever, but Riverside County. He went to all those towns. Still, a lot of them are agricultural towns east of us in Imperial County, Riverside County. Yeah.
So how did he end up in San Diego?
Well, his parents came to San Diego, is the way he tells me the story. They came here. He had siblings who were living in L.A. Mm. And so I've always wanted to research this. He says So he came with his family, my mom and my siblings, in 1976.
Okay.
And he said it was right around July 4th, 1976.
Okay.
And he said that their goal was to go up north to L.A. But he says, again, and I don't know how you could even verify this, that it was around that time or just at that time that the San Clemente checkpoint was put up. Yeah. And so I don't know the exact date, but...
I can tell you exactly what the date was.
Oh, really?
Really?
It was... getting to San Clemente checkpoint could take you hours.
Yeah.
It was so... It was a tight, strict place to try and get through. And so trying to get north of San Diego wasn't as easy as it got to be a little bit later. But they were literally... I mean, just even... I worked at San Onofre for a while, yeah. And I hurt my knee the first time. And I'll tell you what, just trying to cross to get there... You have to leave like 6 o'clock in the morning, otherwise you would never get there.
Right.
Just a checkpoint.
Yeah, just to get to the checkpoint.
Yeah.
It's horrendous. Now you can just, it's so
yeah,
easy.
They're hardly even there now.
Yeah.
So they stayed here in an apartment in Barrio Logan,
mm-hmm.
With five kids. And then they stayed. My dad worked in
only five. Restaurant.
Only five.
Only five.
I was six, but I came later. Only five.
Only
and
five.
My dad worked over in downtown at a restaurant, being a busboy. And he did that for a while. And then he got a job being a janitor here in the community with the Barrio Station, a nonprofit mm-hmm. in the community. And he did that for 26
years. That
was
just after wow. the whole... Chicano Park thing happened,
yeah,
right?
That
right
was,
around that same
yeah,
time?
That, well, that was, Chicano Park was 71.
Yeah.
And they came 76, so they were here a few years later, but a lot of the Chicano...
You know, that was when, like, the foundation for Chicano Park
exactly,
was
I was just saying
off.
That and the Chicano Federation mm-hmm. and sort of all these organizations about Latino empowerment and social services for people of color began, and that's when he got that job with the Barrio Station. He... was offered to come and do a little bit of work here and there, and then he just worked his way up to being janitor because he only had a third grade education.
So, yeah.
Well, that's all he ever had. My mom was the same way. She was a stay-at-home, obviously, mm-hmm. with all the kids, and then I was an accident. My mom was 42.
You're supposed to say surprise.
Oh, okay. I was surprised.
You're supposed to say surprise.
Well, my mom was 42. She didn't expect it.
Yeah.
I remember she used to tell me, she passed away now 6 years ago, but she used to say that the doctors said, you know, you're up there in age. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. are you sure you want to go through with the pregnancy?
Back then, that would be unusual. These days,
yeah.
it's not
right.
unusual at all.
Right.
to
right.
have kids
right. yeah.
over 40. Yeah.
Right.
yeah.
yeah but back
yeah.
then, there were a lot of
But you're still,
risk.
You're still considered a geriatric, they classify you as geriatric mother once. Or geriatric a pregnancy so like after 35.
35,
yeah, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, we're expecting our second, and we just went to go see the doctor, and my wife's only 33, and they're like, you know, you're getting up there in age, we got to do more tests. And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm 33.
Yeah.
But apparently, you know, the closer you get to 35, you got to watch
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Surprised she didn't slap him.
Yeah, I know. So you grow up in Barrio Logan,
right?
Right. You go to San Diego High. How come you ended up staying out of trouble back in that time? That was a rough era. Yeah.
That was a really tough time. They have this show on like the Discovery Channel or the one of those channels. It's called Gangland.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've got a mm-hmm. series of what happened here in the 80s and early 90s. And a lot of folk, faces I recognize there that were from the neighborhood, you
mm-hmm.
know. And it was a tough time. This question is something that I've always been asked and I've never been able to answer. Last week, I was talking to someone. I don't remember who it was. I think it was a teacher, because as people have found out that I'm running, they're contacting me on Facebook and they're saying,
yeah.
we're so proud of you, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking to a high school teacher, Ms. Weiss, who's now a principal, I think, at Mission Bay. And she was asking me, and I was thinking about it, and I think it was really my brothers who were protective, because they were all involved in gangs. They were in gangs, they were spent some time in jail, because
mm-hmm.
It was such a hard time. I think they were very protective of me. I
How
was
much
the youngest.
Younger were you?
So I was 8 years younger than my my brother who comes
before. So you really had another set of parents.
Yeah. So, you know, they all took care of me. And I think that's what it was, because I wasn't exposed to a lot. And I saw all those guys, you know, the mm-hmm. folks who hung out in the neighborhood, but they all were really always, I think, also protective. I think that was the case with all the younger siblings for the kids in that generation that were involved in gangs, and they saw that it was really not, you know, a good life. So I think I owe it to them, and obviously my parents, which, you know, worked really hard to try to make things happen for us. And I always remember thinking, and my mom going to work and my dad all the time, and how hard it was. We were poor, and my mom made things, you know, things happen. We always had a meal on the table, but it was tough times. And I think I always thought, like, how do we get out of this? And it's they say, you know, education, even though they didn't know what it was, because they both had a third grade education. And when I end up going to college, they're like, what do you mean college? Like, what is that? You graduated high school, like, don't you go work now so you can help the family? And no, I went off to college, and you know, thank God for that, because it's what really opened the doors for all that I've been
doing. So what did you study at San Diego State?
I studied psychology. I went in thinking, I was undecided when I went in, but I thought I wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. So I took a whole, and I loved math, and I was pretty good at it without even trying too much. It was my favorite subject, and I took up to calculus 3, I think it was. It was like my first week in calculus 3, and so I knew I wanted to be a math teacher, but what we were doing in calculus was just like, I never learned it when I was in school, and so I said, when am I ever going to even use this? Yeah. Like, when am I going to teach this to kids? Like, why? Yeah. So I was kind of like, you know, I didn't have a mentor for that. I was just, oh, you know, maybe this is not it. At the same time, I took a psychology course, and that was really interesting. And then the path I took when I started taking psychology is I was going to pursue, like, school counseling, school psychology, something in that realm, and my research was based on that. I ended up graduating with honors from San Diego State, and I do social work because, I say I'm going to take a year off for grad school. I'll do social work. And I did that, and I spent a lot of time. I really enjoyed just working with people, talking to people, letting them talk about their problems to me, trying to figure out how we could help them. But it was a lot of paperwork, too. Like, it was just, I was spending more time paperwork than actually talking and helping people. Mm-hmm. So that really, I really didn't like that. Same time, I applied to this program in Sacramento, which was a fellows program. It's like an internship, but it's paid full-time, mm-hmm. whole thing.
A fellowship.
Yeah. And I go up there. I'm surprised that I get picked, because I have no political experience besides my community activism and through the church and things like
what
that.
What do you think they picked you?
So that's the other thing. Why I made it this far and why people have supported me, I think somebody said that people saw promise in me. And my wife, mm-hmm. who works with kids, mm-hmm. She says, you know, people who are educators see promise in everyone. And so they try to encourage kids to do well. And I think people encourage me and I think maybe the program saw promise. The people who interviewed me, the panel, saw some promise that perhaps, you know, I was always service oriented. Mm-hmm. Again, another high school college advisor or counselor in high school, Catherine Sotelo, she sent me a Facebook as well. She said, you know, I'm really proud of you. You were my first cohort when I started my counseling career, mm-hmm. at San Diego High School. And you were my first cohort, and I always remember you because you said you always wanted to come back to your community and do good. And so I think I always wanted to do that. I always wanted to do service, but I never knew, and I didn't know anybody in politics, and I wasn't involved in politics, so I didn't know that politics was a way to give back to the community. I was selected to the program, and I learned, you know, rather quickly that you can really impact people's lives by being involved in politics, whether it's policy making or working for elected officials, and so I did that for a year, and I actually really enjoyed working in Sacramento, learning about state government. Mm-hmm. But I did not like Sacramento's bubble. It was sort of a, like, people forgot, like, that in Sacramento you represent and you make laws that impact people, like, in a little town miles away. And I felt a real disconnect. And so I came back home. And then that's when I started working for here in San Diego. And I started got a job with a state senator. And that's how I really got into politics here.
So who gave you your big break here? Who was it?
It was Denise Duchenne. She was a senator, state senator for two terms. She was a chairwoman for the budget committee in the state. So I got to learn a lot about the budget. And
so when did you decide you wanted to be... City Council is really your first political office,
yeah.
right?
It was.
I mean, who had this district before you?
Ben Wesso. What happened? This is just like this time. I have a lot of faith that things happen for a reason, and you're always being given opportunities, and so you should really consider taking those opportunities, and that's what I've done with the mayor's race. But it was the same thing with the council. Ben was leaving. He was vacating the office, and so there was going to be no one, no incumbent. And so,
this was just after term limits, right? And did he term out? Was
he took a position,
or was this when he
person who was in the assembly left the assembly seat? So then he ran for that assembly seat.
Yeah, right. When he ran. And he hadn't termed out yet. He would have termed out.
Right. No.
He would have termed out.
He had a whole term left.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But he had bigger office now. And mm-hmm. now Ben's moved on to.
Now he's a senator.
Senator.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They move really quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens quick sometimes, right?
Yeah. So I ran because I'd done a lot of work through the senator's office in all the neighborhoods of District 8 and South Bay in general, but also because. I had a lot of people. I did a lot of nonprofit work, which I skipped over earlier, but I was involved with the Barrio Logan College Institute. They work with first generation, just like me, first generation college students, get them on the path to college. And I worked with Family Health Centers of San Diego doing HIV, AIDS, teen pregnancy prevention stuff, tobacco programs, prevention programs. So I got to know a lot of people in the nonprofit sector. And what's interesting is that when I told them about it, everybody was like, yeah, that's good. But nobody really knew what it meant because my world was a nonprofit world. I had some political friends, but it was really primarily my church network and my...
What's your church?
Christ the King Church on 32nd and Imperial. That was my church. Now we're here at Our Lady's right down the street. Okay. We're just closer, and it works out for our daughter's nap time schedule. But gotta adapt to their schedule. So, I got into that, and it was nobody thought I could win. I was running against two really big names. It was Insunza, who had been a council member before, and Weso. The brother of the outgoing council member.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So everybody said, "Oh, he's got no name ID, so he doesn't have a real shot."
So how did you win?
It worked really hard, just the same way we're doing now.
How long was that campaign?
That one was longer. It was it started in earnest about January of that year, and the election was in June.
Okay, so you had January, February, June.
5 months.
5 months.
Yeah, 5 months.
5 months.
And then
that was still a special election. So this is similar in that same sense.
Well, this one's much shorter.
It's only what, a month and a half really before the absentee ballots.
Absentee ballots, right? They're now about 30 days away.
Once you get that number in, you're lost.
Right.
Yeah. Let me ask you. So there's a couple of things I want to ask you. First thing I want to ask you is where's your inspiration come from? What inspired you to take this step? Because you're a little late to the game from the initial crowd that
right.
first jumped in, the Nathan Fletchers, the Faulkners, right. all these people. What inspired you to take this step now?
I think it was the lack of inspiration from the other candidates.
Yeah.
I'm native, born and raised here, mm-hmm. And then I've served on the council now for 3 years,
yeah.
And I served under two different administrations, mm-hmm. two different mayors. And under the first mayor, I really saw the lack of interest in communities that are important to me, that I think need to be brought into the city and feel like they're a part of the city and feel that they're cared about. I felt that was really lacking during the first administration. The second administration was way more open, and accepting and wanting to bring people in and all that, and that was good. And so the candidates that were coming forward mm-hmm. to me were just all... just like the past. Mm-hmm. In San Diego, it's been very clear up until this last election, small group of downtown interests really control the agenda, control who gets elected, control what happens and doesn't happen. Yeah. And I witnessed that for 2 years as a council member, my first 2 years. And it was very difficult to get the focus and the attention on everyday people and neighborhoods and all that.
Yeah.
So I was not excited about what the values of other folks were, and I felt that my values were more in line with the average San Diegan. And okay. That's a story that we're trying to share with others.
And that's a powerful story because, as you know, I'm a native too, and the old boy network, mm-hmm. as we call it in San Diego, was, you know, has been damning.
It's alive and well.
Yeah, and it's damning to our city in many ways.
Right.
And yet, you know, what makes you unafraid of the political BS that of stepping into the fray, because you're going into the swamp, right?
Yep.
And you have to be able to swim with the crocodiles and alligators and all the other snakes that are there.
Right.
How do you navigate that? And I'm asking because it's, you know, politics is a dirty game, and you know, unfortunately, there's no way around. You can't give everybody what they want all the time.
Right.
How do you navigate that water? And you've been in it with the city council,
right.
So you get to...
No, and definitely for the last 3 years, you know, I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been on the losing end of votes, you know, 7-1, and it feels lonely when you're by yourself.
Yeah.
And everybody else is saying, you know, this is the right thing to do, and you know, my strong convictions say, no, that's not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And so I can stand up, you know, and say no when it's time to say no, and I'll be there with you, working right along if I think it's the right thing to do. And that's what I've done. I've worked with folks when it's right to work with folks, and we agree on issues. And I've also been on the losing end where everybody sort of goes along to get along, and it's not really my style. I'm very truthful. I'm very forthcoming. There was a lot of folks who felt... Some people felt offended by particularly during the Sanders administration, his staff was offended by my questioning of city staff on issues that, you know, were important to them.
Yeah.
And then other people see that as courageous because I'm actually speaking up.
Yeah.
So that's how you navigate it, and it is shark-infested waters for sure. At the end of the day, I got into my council race, and it was a great experience to help me decide whether to do this or not.
Uh-huh.
I spent a lot of time as a man of faith praying over that, uh-huh. and making sure that I was going to be okay with going into it, and win or lose, I was going to, you know, put my effort there, and I was not going to change who I was for any reason. And I did that successfully with that campaign. I had to go through the same self-evaluation this time around, which is why I got behind and others were so ahead.
Yeah.
You know, could I get into a mayor's race, and with all of the stuff going on, mm-hmm. could I be who I am and not try to become somebody else,
yeah.
and keep true to my faith, my values, and all of that? And that's really what keeps me going.
Awesome.
And then, I mean, people are going to criticize you. They're going to say, I think the lead, there's a few criticisms. First, from the outside, right, you're inexperienced. They're going to say, you haven't been around long enough. You know, Fletcher was in the state, you know, he was up
assemblyman for assemblyman. Like 1 year more than I've been a council member.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
He was a state assemblyman. He's got a lot of advantages that you don't have, though. He really does in a lot of ways, right? I mean, his wife was a Bush appointee, so he's definitely very aware of how the political machine works. He's got a lot more institutional knowledge, I would think, than... because of that experience that is coming maybe familially from his wife or from his firsthand experience. He was an institutional candidate, and now he's trying to become the de facto Democratic candidate as well. Labor's behind him, in a way.
Okay.
Lori Saldana came out for him, a lot of the endorsements he's getting.
Lori?
I thought she did. Who was it that came out?
No, Lori's.
Lorena. I'm sorry. It was Lorena.
Okay. Lori's still a candidate as far as I know.
Wait a minute, but you see what I mean.
So
he comes across, and then Kevin Faulkner is definitely part of the institution. He's got a lot of experience, and they're both, at least their public images are really, they're very likable guys. I'm not saying you're not likable, but they're also both very likable guys. Kevin has always seemed very
nice to me.
Yeah.
You know, he seems very typical San Diego. And Fletcher has that kind of typical San Diego thing going on for him as well. Those are challenges that you have to address.
Well, I think probably is the typical old San Diego. A typical new San Diego is me. You know, it's different. We're a much more diverse community where we, the southern part of the city, and everybody talks about the divide, you know, the big divide in the city, which people say north of 8, south of 8. I think the largest divide is really south of the 94, north of the 94. We said that and believe that. And so that exists. But we have very distinct backgrounds. You know, I'm deaf, blue collar. Like I said earlier, my dad a janitor, my mom, fast food restaurants, working hard, homeless for a little while, my family. We come from different worlds, and we have different perspective in life. And so I think people will start to distinguish us. It'll be very clear, you know, who's who and who stands for what. And it'll be obvious soon enough. The campaign just got started a week ago. And
they've been campaigning longer than
they have, you're right.
You know, they've been campaigning a lot longer than you. Fletcher's got a lot more name recognition than Faulkner.
Right.
And Faulkner probably has a lot more,
That's because Nathan just ran last year,
yeah,
right?
Well, he's been waiting to run again for what he wants to be mayor.
Right.
I don't fault people ambition. I don't see that as a bad thing at all. You know, I mean, that's something that everybody always, I think, jumps all over, particularly politicians about. You know, it's because they have ambitions.
Right.
Yeah, but in this situation, it's interesting is that San Diegans are looking for, especially after this whole thing with Filner, they're looking for somebody who with honor, somebody with integrity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those things really resonate very highly, and I think there is a demographic shift in San Diego that I think you were alluding to, which I think is sort of intriguing. It's sort of the first time I've actually heard anybody bring it up in this sort of context, and that is that, you know, there is a new sort of face in San Diego that people haven't talked about. And you and I were talking earlier before you guys got here about, you know, like your constituency, you know, and you know how you get and I know you're not just looking at just the Latino vote. I know that. So the idea is, you know, who do you see as your constituency?
The people in RB.
Yeah, you build coalitions and you talk about your values. I think values are across all racial lines.
How do you do that in 6 weeks?
Well, you got to work really hard. You got to raise money. You got to get on TV. You got to do all the things that a typical campaign does.
As many podcasts as you can.
Yeah. Be on TV, the news, podcasts, email, program, grassroots effort. I mean, that's going to distinguish myself from the other campaigns as well. It's they will not be as robust as this. I can tell you that.
They have significant war chests at this point in time, you would think. I mean, are you going to be able to garner? I mean, that's going to make a difference, right?
So
they'll be able to do media buys.
Right.
You know,
we'll be able to do media buys too. And what's going to happen is this will start to become a three-person race very quickly by the media who covers it and by the reality of who's going to have support from the different organizations.
Who's going to be your big supporter? Because I know, right, for Fletcher, it's Qualcomm. That's his big money supporter, and for Faulkner, I forget who it is.
He's the Republican establishment.
Yeah, Republican
establishment. Right.
So who's your big money supporter?
My base is going to be the same base that it was the last time. I had over 1,000 individuals contribute to my campaign when I ran for city council, and we're going to have that and then some, and so that's why I'm spending.
Form, it just keeps going.
Right.
Individual.
Well, and there was a lot of folks who contributed only, you know, $5, $10, $20, which adds up if you get 1,000 people. Obviously, you know, it's going to take more than that. But remember that campaigns are about messaging and getting your message out and having people be able to differentiate who people are. I think it's going to be very easy to differentiate me, what I stand for. I've been very solid in my track record as far as where I stand, where my values are. I think the other candidates are going to probably have to spend that money to try to create an image of, you know, who they are. One being, I think, you know, really partisan Republican, and the other very partisan Republican before and now. Maybe very partisan Democrat, who knows? You know, that's for people to decide and for people to define. I've always been a Democrat, progressive, working for average people.
Do you think that's what got Filner elected this last time around was him being a progressive Democrat, or was it that it was a presidential election? You know, it was there's more of a turnout for Democrats at that time. People were just voting more along party lines at that point in time. Whereas you're not going to get that in the special election.
Right.
Democrats are much harder to get out of, off their butts.
But Democrats are still a majority of the electorate, even in special elections, which we forget.
They're the majority of people that go to polls are Democrats.
Plurality. I mean, make that clear. They're not 50% plus one, but they're the
no. But my point is that it's it's always harder to get, I think, for Democrats to get their voters out to vote, even though they may be more, they may represent a larger percentage of the population of whatever region it is. Right. There's 55, I saw 56% Democrats, 48% Republican, and then the rest are kind of independent, maybe, or maybe even a little less. Something along those lines. It's favored Democrat for the San Diego County, I think is the last I heard. So it's obviously favored, particularly towards the urban centers. You get a lot more Democrats than Republicans. But at the same time, you know, Republicans vote. They vote.
But
they
so do Democrats. That's what people
and
forget.
They vote in line on party. You know.
Right, but we've taken a look at the numbers. Democrats go out and vote, and they vote more than in numbers larger than Republican. That's. If you've got a good campaign that gets the message out and identifies who is the Democrat, which is how that's what we're going to do, it's a grassroots campaign, then that's the margin of victory. And also those independents, and there's some Republicans that are willing to cross over to elect someone who's really about the future of San Diego and not going back to that good old boys network we talked about.
Dave, let me ask you a question. When last year when Filner was running and we did a couple of his mayoral candidates, when they had the things at Fox that we did with the debates, and the first time Bob got up and said, well, I'm just a poor Democrat, you know, and I remember thinking, you know, and I'm going to be very blunt here, and I'm probably going to use one foul word, you know, I started thinking in my head, and I was next to Raul and I think Erica was there, and we were like going, you know, I'm so sick of hearing this, a poor Democrat shit, you know, because it's something that rings from the 1970s, and the demographic, even for Democrats, is not just the poor Democrat who just resides under social issues, they're much more economically vibrant, they have other concerns than the 70s Democrat, and not that the 70s Democrat isn't important, but how do you recouch or create a vision of what the Democrat of 2013, or let's say the 21st century, really represents today, and how that image would connect with moderate, maybe even moderate Republicans as well.
Absolutely. The Democratic values are to make sure that society gives everybody a chance to be successful. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that means supporting social welfare programs. That definitely means supporting our education system, not only K-12, but our higher ed system. Mm-hmm. You know, I would have never have been able to afford college without the support that grants and all those funds that were given to me, even though I did have to work a little bit to make sure I paid the bills. But those are all democratic principles. We believe in giving people who want to work hard a chance to be successful. And so that's the crossover appeal. That's those are the new Democrats, and most definitely not just poor. I mean, it's working class for sure. The middle class, and creating more middle class jobs. And then there are those who have the values of Democrats who are, you know, probably higher than middle class.
Yeah.
And those folks who at one point, you know, needed support to go to college like me, or who's had a single mom who needed to get some financial support from the government to get something to eat, get something on the table to eat, and those social programs are really important. First-time home buyers, just like me, FHA, a federal program. In San Diego today, there's some, but. Both my wife and I worked, and we bought this home, and we could have never bought it without the FHA program. That's a federal program.
Yeah.
So there's a reason that government exists, and I think it's to help people be successful and to leverage private investment, which is the other thing that's going to be talked about from my perspective in this campaign. Yeah. Is how do we leverage how do we leverage private investment dollars using public dollars through federal sources and state sources and maybe even some local sources?
That leads me to my next question. And my next question was going to be, like, what do you see as like your, it could be three or four or five, whatever, big issues or main things you want to try to attack as mayor?
Yeah, that last one that I just talked about is really one of them. It's making sure that investment occurs in all communities and we can get job creation, which is really the second one. How do we create jobs? Yeah. Well, you got to do that by construction is one. So private investment leads to development, leads to startup businesses along some of our corridors that have been vacant and have been abandoned over the years or just have bad uses, right? So affordable housing so that you can actually attract employers who want to hire employees that can afford to live in the city, not have to commute to North County or to Riverside County or across the border to come to work. Making sure that our pillars of our economy, like tourism industry and the military, stay here because they're strong and we need them. But make sure that those jobs in the tourism industry, for example, are good paying jobs, not just minimum wage jobs, because that creates some demands on government as well. Like if you don't have affordable housing, how are you going to be able to live here on an $8 now? Now it's going up to, I think, 9 or 10. But, you know, then you got to have health care for your kids. And so there's a way to create those middle-class jobs. We're going to see that with the convention center. There's an agreement that makes sure that those hotel employees that are coming in have sustainable wages and they have benefits. And so continuing down that path. And obviously, last and definitely not least, is continuing to invest from the city's perspective in all of the infrastructure needs of the city. So we've got park deficient communities throughout this entire city. There's parks missing in neighborhoods that have been built recently that we just never had enough of the funds to actually build those amenities in those communities, again, throughout the entire city. Obviously, our roads, which we've done a lot on. We've really spent a significant amount of dollars on fixing roads, but there's still a long way to go. Streetlights in some of these communities that have, for example, issues with public safety. We know that streetlights are helpful and that they can make people feel more secure in their neighborhood. So all of that investment needs to occur as well.
Yeah, it's always one of those things where if you invest back, people have there's always this reverse logic. If you hire people to do the work and they pay taxes, they're paying into the tax base, so it's sort of it's like it feeds on itself. But if you don't give the jobs, then you just become more of a burden to the social welfare system. So the impetus should be to help create jobs and know that eventually you will reap the reward because the tax base goes up because more people are paying in the tax base. You know, simple logic, but unfortunately in politics, as we know, forgotten. It gets lost. And I can say that as a political scientist. So. Right, that's so why I teach it.
I have the super annoying question for you.
Maybe eat some candy one.
So you can do a nice spit take.
Give me a knife. I'm going to smack him in the back of the head or something along the way.
For the first time today. A lot of people think that because you're not as well known as the other candidates, that you see this more as an opportunity to increase your name recognition, that you're not, and to maybe become a power broker in a way for this area more than you already are, as opposed to really wanting this office. You know, they see this as more as you positioning yourself for something bigger or something else, something different.
I can tell you it's not for that. This is going to be really hard. I mean, it's a lot of work, a lot of hours. We're here, and it's 7:30 at night. And my wife just texted me and asked if I was coming over to her mom's house because it's her mom's birthday. I would not be doing this if I didn't think I could have the opportunity to serve as mayor of the city. I've seen the good work that I've been a part of over the last 3 years coming in and seeing our budget just be slashed by Mayor Sanders cutting our vital public services like libraries. I grew up going to my local library. That's where I had my access to the internet. That's where I had a chance to have a computer and a printer to do my homework. And libraries are near and dear to my heart, and there's no way we should continue to do that. Came in and provided some common sense solutions to get our budget in line. most of them which were adopted the first year as council member. So we've had too much progress to not allow it to continue to go back into really the San Diego of the 1900s, where a few people controlled the agenda and the rest of us were on the outside looking in. So I want to be mayor because our city needs a mayor like me with my values, with my experience. And this isn't, you know, I actually am having fun because we've got such a positive campaign with a lot of energy, but it's not like I could have just continued to be a council member and continue to advocate and do the things that I do and have no problem. It's definitely not about building name ID. It's an opportunity that opened up just like when I first ran for council that I can't let go by because I feel so strongly about it.
So how do you communicate your message to the white woman in her mid-30s in Rancho Bernardo?
Go and we talk to her.
I mean, it's easier said than done. It's not like you, I mean, Escondido. I was talking to chief of police in Escondido, and they've got an election coming up there as well.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, yeah, in Escondido they go and they bang on doors. But Escondido's a much smaller. It's a big city.
We can still bang on doors. We were out today.
How do you meet? That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
To go meet.
You need a lot of volunteers, which is what we had today, and we have every night. And you've got to get on the phone too. You can't just do it. And you got to get on TV, so people start to recognize you. It's like any other campaign, and you got to be creative with social media. That's the new technology, and you got to excite people to come out and vote for something they can believe in. And that's the message that we're putting forward, and that's the calculus that we have to be successful. At the end of the day, November 19th, we'll find out whether that was good enough or not. I think it is. Just like early on in my city council race, many people think I have no shot. We'll see, you know, where that goes. I have the ability to campaign, I think, is very, very strong. The organization is very strong. And I can tell you, I don't think the last time I saw an organization like this was with Donna's write-in campaign in 2005. And that was very, very short. And that time you had to get people to bubble in and write a name, which it's hard enough to get them to bubble in, you know, fill in the bubble when you go vote. So the excitement is there, the volunteers are there, the dedication is there. The execution needs to happen with me raising money so that I can, you know, be on TV and send out mail pieces and have walk pieces. And then the volunteers just have to continue coming so that we can continue spreading them throughout the city so they can talk people face to face.
So where would you put them? Where are you going to do with the new Charger Stadium?
Well, you know, I haven't really seen that proposal.
There hasn't really been one.
Okay, so that's what I keep on wondering. People keep on asking me, and then I say, well, I haven't seen the proposal, and they're like, well, there isn't one. Well, okay, if there isn't one, I'm not really talking about
it.
It's here.
Last week, that's what
it's a cloud.
That's what talked about too last week, was that he's like, they've heard vague kind of ideas about where they want to put it. But no.
Well, there's a downtown option, right? But that required redevelopment's money, which is no longer there.
Nobody's come up with any broken it down financially.
Well, what you need to have is you need to have an investment group that wants to put in real money, like farmers did up in LA.
Exactly. Yep.
And I haven't heard.
If the city ends up contributing money, why can't the city take ownership of the team in this, like Green Bay?
Yeah, that's because I think the NFL doesn't allow it anymore. From what I understand, you have to petition it or something like that. I think that's a great idea.
You're the football guy here.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, I don't know that answer to that question, but I think it's an intriguing one. I mean,
send a letter to the NFL and ask them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I mean that would be. But the other part of that would be the investment.
$400 million on the conservative end, from what?
Oh, there's no way. No,
it was a lot.
It's going to be $3/4 of $1 billion for a stadium anywhere in San Diego.
Yeah.
Especially making multi-use, obviously. So that's the whole thing you've got to build around.
The Falcon site is the ideal site.
I do too. All the modes
of transportation coming there. Mm-hmm. I, at one point, somebody was talking about this idea of bringing like San Diego State housing or something there.
Yeah.
I think that makes total sense. You can get kids going on the trolley from that station to the campus, and you raise money that way. It's a development.
Yeah, they were going to build an Adobe Falls. They were going to make a connector road to San Diego State through Adobe Falls and
a road. But no, you just take a trolley. Why?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Oh, no, absolutely.
Their students going to class take the trolley.
Yeah,
And so I still think that sort of makes sense, but I haven't seen any, again, real proposals.
Yeah. The truth is that we need a new stadium. I mean, there's no, we're losing money because our stadium, it's not, it's been a great history. I remember when they first opened it. Okay, that's how old I am. But the truth is that if we need, I mean, it'll drive more, will drive more revenue. There's so many positives to it other than being hamstrung
well,
like
we
are
right
now. We
gotta get people showing up to the games in order to get
revenue.
Well,
that's the other part of the equation.
There's a lot of folks that have built stadiums in other cities and people aren't showing up to the games, right? I don't know how they're, are they breaking even or are they making money?
Well, because you have to make multi-use. You make them multi-use, right. Multi-purpose, so you can generate.
The idea of convention joint with, I think that's a really interesting one.
Wow.
I also think that this area is prime for us to get into the MLS and get a soccer team here.
Yeah, big time.
And I think there's plenty of, you can go talk to the guy who owns the Cholos in Tijuana.
Mm-hmm.
He's got, I think, plenty of capital, and maybe he'd be interested in doing a joint venture like that.
Hank Rohn, you want to take Hank Rohn? I mean, I don't know a lot of people would feel comfortable with him. He's got a reputation.
Yeah, he's got a reputation.
Yeah, he's got a very...
Well, another ownership group. It doesn't have to be him. But, there's a guy who owns the Chivas who is also pretty wealthy.
But they just had the Jolos and the Chivas playing out here.
Yeah, it was a fun game.
But that didn't sell out.
It was awesome.
That didn't sell out, and that was the big remark that everybody made, that wasn't, they were expecting.
Wait, no, that was America Cholos. That was not Chivas.
It was not Chivas?
No. I went to the game.
Yeah, if Chivas was here, I'm sure it would have been. Yeah.
But it was still good. It was a good game. You know, but that's why it's got to be multi-purpose. So you build it big enough to make football there, but you also, Seattle has, I think, that stadium, and their soccer team is just like phenomenal, and the crowd is just great. And I mean, we gotta think outside the box. We can just build a stadium.
See, I've always been, because I'm a native San Diegan, so I've always been. I think we've had too much mediocrity in our city government and politics, that, in general. I think people are kind of just wallowing. And what happens, it becomes almost an epidemic, if you would, because it's people just kind of just start business as usual. And so what I find fascinating from our conversation just in this brief time has just been, at least I feel, my sense is that you have a vision for another direction and not wallowing in the mediocrity that is so pervasive. Sometimes, damning in our city government,
We're doing ourselves in. And the other problem is that people, somebody asked me today, like, what's one thing you'd like to leave as a legacy? And previous administration, Sanders administration, the legacy was those big projects. Let's build expansion of the convention center. Let's build the library. Let's do that bridge in the ballpark. I think Those are all good things for the community, when we build those types of assets. But we've got to get back to like basics, people actually believing in government and trusting in government. That's really key to us being a successful city, when people feel like government's being responsive.
Wow.
Like they care about what's happening to all of us.
Wow.
And that's one thing that I definitely would want to, make sure that people remembered if I'm lucky enough to be mayor of the city.
One of the things I was very critical about in this city was when our airport, because years ago we've been trying to get an airport built here, and I thought we could be the hub to Latin America, we could be the hub, there's so much we could do. And I remember when Atlanta built their big airport, which has been 30 years ago now, where Atlanta was 30 years ago versus what it is today as a result of the infusion of money, because of having, it's like we can never get ourselves out of the mindset of just, like we'll put a mini mall in every corner, but we can't get ourselves around the idea of building a real airport that allows us to be international city, and really open up San Diego to what its capability happens to be. And that's a part that I think, as for anybody who's going to be mayor, that is something we have to really confront, and trying to get the small, sometimes small-minded people to have a bigger picture of what the capabilities of our city can actually become.
Well, I think that's part of building the trust. People didn't vote for that new airport facility, and I think it was partly due to, gosh, is government really doing the right thing? We were in the middle of a lot of bad things happening in our city, and we had this unfortunate episode this year with this mayor, but other than that, I think we're getting back on track, and so the job of the next mayor will be to make sure that we continue down the right track.
You need to be a visionary. You need to have a visionary, somebody who's thinking about not just today, but you know, if you want to generate jobs, you've got to create a mechanism that's going to open up for jobs.
Right.
Whatever that is, whether it's a new airport that generates jobs or whatever it is, you've got to have a mechanism that opens up the door to create new wealth, new businesses coming to your area. And and if no one's thinking in that agenda, whether even if it takes a decade down the road for that to happen, if you don't start having that discussion now, then a decade's going to go by and you're going to be stuck in the same,
right.
You know. And I look at our downtown, I think, oh, it looks so beautiful, but look at our downtown. It's almost all high rises and hotels, not businesses.
Right.
And that's when you look at it, I go, that's not a good sign. We've got more businesses, you got more hotels and high rises and condos than you do have, you know, real business. And that's, we need more.
So many of those condos are empty.
Yeah, they're empty condos, too. That's the other thing.
Night, and there's five or six lights on. I don't know where they get the money to keep building these things.
You know, who can afford to live in them, you know? Community pot, you know?
Three towers where they took all the deposits and then they had to give all the deposit money back because they weren't building them on time.
Right.
Originally they were going to sell them all, and then they realized they couldn't sell them all, so now they're renting out two of the towers and trying to sell half of one, and they still haven't been able to sell that one. It's all rentals now. And then you go down further into East Village, and it's, you know, what hasn't been bought up by investors and rented out, you know, just sits empty.
Yeah.
Because normal people can't buy there.
Right.
You know, it's $500,000 for 400, 500 square foot one bedroom. You know, they don't come with closets because I tour them. Tiny. They're tiny and they're expensive.
They are closets.
You know, and HOA. I mean, I live in Europe. I can deal with small spaces, you know, and I know what that means. These are not European. These are overpriced.
Yeah, but that's the real estate speculators that have also run. Right. They really run San Diego.
But they're doing fine.
Yeah.
I don't think that those.
Well, because they can sit because they got plenty of money. They can just sit and wait.
Well,
it comes back.
They sit and wait. It kind of benefits them in the long run. You turn them into rentals. You wait out the construction defect, statute of limitations, and then you start selling them.
Yeah,
off.
But here's what's going to happen. The people, like we talked about earlier, the wages in San Diego and versus the cost of living are like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, the truth of the matter is that our cost of living is so high that, and the wages are so low that there's no way, and the people are speculating, hoping they're going to come back, but it probably won't be in our lifetime if they ever go back, because it's just not, there's no money.
Or we just build another bubble.
Exactly, yeah, exactly, exactly.
But is that how you solve?
No.
It's economy.
Absolutely not.
I mean, you know, that's kind of a pessimistic, like...
Well, it's a short-term view.
That's what you see happening in the short term.
Well, it's instant gratification.
How do you stop that from happening if you're in government? How do you stop... That kind of thing.
I think you have to incentivize. You got to look at your other centers of the city. You got to create other urban centers, not, you know, 20-story buildings, but along a lot of our transit corridors. There's a lot of potential, particularly in Southeast San Diego. As you go on the Orange Line, you go into Encanto, Skyline, Lemon Grove. There's a lot of potential to do a lot of really interesting things there. The problem with the city is exactly what we were talking about earlier, that the focus has been so narrow and lack of vision. And it's like, let's use the easy dollars. Those easy dollars were redevelopment. They're now gone. You got to start thinking outside the box. You got to figure out how you're going to leverage the private investment into other areas. And you got to create other opportunities. And I think people, like, you know, in this community, in Logan, people find it interesting, like they want to sort of come live in an urban environment like that. Golden Hill, you see, you know, really picking up. You've seen it in North Park and South Park. It's, you know, it's happening. That sort of stuff you could replicate in other areas. You've got to have the willingness to sort of focus on that, and that's what we need. We need someone who's going to spend some time on focusing on that. And you'll be seeing some real policy proposals coming from me starting this week on some of those economic development and prosperity policies that I'll put forward.
One of the things I think what you just brought up is very one of the key aspects, I think, of the redevelopment in South Park and North Park has been the small businesses that have grown in there. I mean, you have new restaurants that are new. There's like a new energy, but it's like It's what's been missing on, this, on the middle class, lower middle class scale has been the small, even in this area where we're talking about here.
I don't think you could
such a great thing to have in this area to create a nice mechanism for small, thriving businesses with good, you know, interesting restaurants.
Right. But it's what's happened in South Park is all the kind of lower middle class, working class people have been shoved out because they can't afford to live there anymore. So that's kind of the double-edged.
We got to find a balance between that.
Right? You know, and that's the big problem. Yeah. It's not like if you're making $32,000 a year, you can go find yourself. You know, you're talking about $1,500 a month rent on the low end in a lot of those places.
Yeah. In North Park, but even North Park, 30th Street, there's some nice, there's some interesting, you know, is this what I go through there? I was like, wow, this is really changing and evolving.
Yeah. It's the beer neighborhood.
But we need to create more of those. And I agree with you. My family lives right on the Lemon Grove and Canto border there. Mm-hmm. And my dad was a banker in San Diego for many years, and back in the 60s and 70s. And it's interesting to see how, I mean, I remember Lemon Grove, what Lemon Grove used to be when I was a kid, and look at how what it's kind of changed into. But I think there's a great opportunity in those corridors to really create dynamic sectors of our city, not just leave it just to certain areas.
And centers of employment, too.
Absolutely. You
know, there's no reason people have to be commuting to only two or three places in the city. They commute to downtown, they commute to
like the
UTC area. We got to diversify. That improves quality of life because people aren't on the road for hours and hours. They can get there quicker or they can take public transit.
Yeah.
In fact, in other cities you see, like, you can tell where the places of employment are, and obviously they're in the downtown sections, but there's some other cities that I've been to where maybe there'll be like a couple of mid-rise.
Oh, look at Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You Santa Monica, you got Hollywood, you got North Hollywood, you got West Hollywood, and you got all these.
Going on, yeah, right?
Yeah. Everything's happening around, and it's great because you get a different vibe in every location. Mm-hmm. They all have their own things, and this makes it fun. It makes it interesting to be able to, and it creates new people traversing through the areas, new economic opportunities. Price of housing tends to stabilize in those areas.
Is there something concrete you can do to help keep those neighborhoods from sort of South Parking, from becoming
the gentrification,
from becoming not just gentrified but expensive and squeezing out all the people that kind of made that? I mean, if that happened here, you know, half that would squeeze out almost everybody that lives here, right?
Well, there's a lot of people who own property here, though.
Yeah.
Long-standing families, and I think that's the case in a lot of neighborhoods. But yeah, you're right. You run that potential, and in San Diego, what we've got that we haven't really used effectively is a policy that says we need to have balanced communities. So we also, the reverse of that is we got to look at those really high income areas, and affordable housing needs to go there too. I mean, you can't just put it all in one part of town.
Yeah.
It needs to go into La Jolla, and it actually works out really well there because of all the students. They need affordable housing, so we got to put it there. We got to put it in Rancho Bernardo. You got to put it Rancho Peñasquito, everywhere. I mean, it's just got to go throughout this entire city because that's how you get balanced communities. And And some communities don't want affordable housing, and it's really, you know, nobody should take the whole brunt of affordable housing. If you want to make sure that the city is balanced and that we've got people of all backgrounds intermingling, and
they have to eradicate the ignorance or the fear of what it means to have people from, you know, middle income or lower middle income in those areas, as if they bring a bad element with them,
drugs,
which is sort of this,
is what they say.
Yeah, so that's part of that equation too. I know we probably get. I know you got to get to your wife's birthday.
It's her mom's birthday.
Her mom's birthday. Yeah, we don't want you getting the doghouse, and we don't want to be the doghouse with her either.
Those guys aren't welcome back.
Yeah, you cannot like them anymore. Yeah, you cannot play with those.
We appreciate your time, Thank you so much. Appreciate it so much.
Really nice talking to you guys.